Good afternoon. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Gary Albrecht. I represent the appellant Norman Evo II in this appeal. Mr. Evo is with me today at council tables. As the court may know, this is the second appeal in this case that has come before this court with respect to a very similar issue. In 2011, Mr. Evo pursued successfully a pro se appeal from the trial courts, the same trial judge from which we are now appealing, from Judge Schwartz's order that revived the judgment in 2010. This court set aside that revival order because it was clear from the record that Judge Schwartz had not followed the rules, specifically in accordance with Rule 54H. There was no notice to show cause that had been served on any of the three judgment debtors. There were originally three judgment debtors. Besides Mr. Vo, his parents were also judgment debtors. In the course of the appeal, in the opinion that this court issued on January 26, 2012, the court found that the rules had not been followed, vacated the order reviving the judgment, and remanded it to the trial court. In the context of the decision, and as a result of discovery Mr. Vo had made while he was challenging the 2010 revival, the court invited him to challenge the 1992 judgment reviving order, I should say the order reviving the judgment. Specifically, there was an order rendered by Judge Looney, September 14th of 1992, that revived the original judgment entered in 1986. Mr. Vo was surprised to have found that order in the course of his challenge to the 2010 revival and looked into it further. After the remand, then I was retained and we moved to vacate the 1992 judgment. Our position is that that judgment was invalid, the judgment is void, because it was invalid because there had not been service of process that was effective on the judgment debtors, on any of the three judgment debtors. There was no evidence that any notice to show cause was issued. There was no evidence that notices to show cause were served on any of those judgment debtors. As a result, it's our view that pursuant to 60B, the challenge is that the judgment is void and should be invalidated. And when we went back to the trial court, we started by moving to vacate the 1992 judgment, with the central issue being whether or not the we were able to overcome the presumption that Judge Looney had acted regularly, that her order conformed with the requirements of Rule 54H. Now, as the court may recall, Judge Looney's order from September 14th, 1992 doesn't even refer to Rule 54H. It refers to the statute 1352.102, which, while it does pertain to the revival of judgments, has nothing to do with the procedures for reviving judgments. That set of procedures, which must be strictly followed based upon appellate court decisions, is set out in 54H. And what it involves is filing a motion. Then, once that's filed, the court must issue notice to show cause. Then that notice to show cause must be served personally on the judgment debtors. The court, at the time of, in 1992, there was a different time requirement. In 1992, pursuant to 54H, the court could not act on the motion to revive until at least 10 days had passed from the service of the notice to show cause. That has now been extended to 14 days. Nonetheless, our position is that the record shows the only evidence other than what's in Judge Looney's order, whereby she said that she found that there had been compliance with the statute 1352.102 and applicable rules, whatever that means.
Pardon me, counsel, if yes. I may. I've got a question about the applicable rules language. Why doesn't that mean, in the context of this order, that she had found that 54H had been satisfied? Because that's more than just a reference to the statute, right?
It is more than just a reference to the statute. It's hard to explain the language. Joseph Zabunkovich was the attorney for the Shermans at the time, in 1992, has passed away. So we were able to talk to him about it. I would note that there's a similarity, a very strong similarity, between his petition to revive the judgment and then the order reviving the judgment. There, if you look at the words, the word judgment, for example, is spelled with two E's, which is somewhat unusual in my experience. The formatting is similar, and so on. Now, I can't tell you that he drafted the order that the judge signed, but what I do know is that we have evidence in the record that we obtained during discovery that was not presented to us in the context of the motion to vacate. It only came about when we were opposing the motion to revive the judgment. We have evidence that Mr. Zvonkovich sent a letter to his clients on September 16th of 92, 2 days after Judge Looney issued her order, and he reported to his clients that the judge had entered the order administratively, and there was no hearing required. That, to me, means something. I don't know exactly what it means, but if you look at that in combination with, or in the context of, the registry, the court registry, there are two entries in 1992 as they relate to the revival process. One is the petition to revive, or the motion to revive, and the second is the order reviving it. Now, much has been said, Mr. Ware is going to hammer on this, I'm sure, and Judge Schwartz relied on this, that documents had gone missing from the court file. The only document that we know existed that wasn't in the court file was the petition to revive. That was not a part of the court's file, but it is on the registry of actions. So it was entered by the clerk of court at the time it was filed. That petition was filed on August 25th. It was entered on August 27th. Judge Looney acted on it as of September 14th. Now, one of the more compelling arguments that I make to rebut the presumption of regularity is, if you look at that timing from August August 27th to September 14th, using the timing rules, avoiding intervening weekends and holidays, which was a Labor Day holiday, and if you also keep in mind the fact that there had to be at least 10 days of countable days before the judge could act.
So this is effectively 10 business days.
It was 11 business days. So service, they would have had to have notices to show cause issued and served the day after the motion was filed by the court. Mrs. Bowe, according to the undisputed testimony, the evidence, was living in California at the time. And her husband was living with Mr. Bowe in his home in a ranch outside of Pueblo. Mr. Bowe testified without any contrary testimony evidence that he wasn't ever served with any notice to show cause in 1952. Now, interestingly, Judge Schwartz concluded, as a part of ruling out our motion to vacate, in response to the affidavit of Mr. Bowe that we submitted, that he found that affidavit to be self-serving. Now, that goes to credibility. I don't know how you judge the credibility of someone who's not before the court, who hasn't given any live testimony. It was true at the time that Mr. Bowe had successfully challenged the court's order of revival in 2010. So what's interesting here is one of the points that Judge Schwartz made was that he could not find that Judge Looney didn't follow the rules because her order says she did. Well, interestingly, his order in 2010, which this court overturned, said the same thing. In fact, it said that there was compliance with Rule 54H, and nonetheless, the evidence showed that there had not been compliance. So there are a number of items of evidence that I believe that we have presented to the court, we presented to Judge Schwartz. And by the way, one thing that's really important, I think, here is that in connection with both the motion to vacate and then the subsequent motion to revive the judgment, the issues were identical. The difference was that when we filed the motion to vacate, we didn't have the chance to do discovery. I didn't ask for it until after the judge had ruled. I became concerned that he had made characterizations about my client's credibility, and it became clear, since there were no counter affidavits that were filed, that we needed to know more about what happened in 92. So when I moved to reconsider the denial of the motion to vacate, the 92 judgment. I asked for leave to conduct discovery. Then when the appellee had moved to revive the judgment, we specifically got the right to conduct discovery because we had objected to the petition to revive or the motion to revive, and a trial was going to be set for that. Now, I expect that Mr. Ware is going to say that these issues are different, but they were identical. And if you look at the record from the trial that was conducted on September 6th, everything, including his argument, went to the issue of whether or not the 1992 judgment was valid, or if it should be set aside as void based on invalid service process, non-existent service process. So the issue was tried September 6th, in my view, with the consent of the parties and with the consent of the judge. And that was the only issue in play at that time. And I think, you know, frankly, I think we had the benefit then of some discovery that had been conducted, because by that time, the petition to revive had surfaced. The letter that Mr. Zlankovich sent to his clients dated September 16th, 1992, had surfaced. All of that leads to the evidence that I believe overcomes the presumption of regularity. Now, on the other hand, if you look at what Judge Schwartz found and ruled on with respect to why we didn't overcome it, I think it's a series of presumptions. It's a presumption that when Judge Looney referred to applicable rules, she must have had Rule 54H in mind. There is no evidence of that. Remember that there were three judgment debtors. One of the things that's important is if you look at the Registry of Actions, if you assume that documents went missing from the file, they're neither on the registry nor in the file. That's an important distinction to make. There would have been at least one notice to show cause, if not three, one for each judgment debtor. There would have been three proofs of service, one for each judgment debtor. None of those are on the registry, and none of those were in the court file or in Mr. Sherman's file.
There was some testimony from a record supervisor that gave an explanation of why documents might have gone missing, and that would dealt with the computer transition.
Yes.
Did that testimony offer a similar explanation for why the document, a missing document, would not show up in the registry, or does that stand totally unexplained on this record? Do you see the distinction, Brian?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think I asked her that very question. If she was able to determine whether or not items were missing from the registry or items were missing that had been filed, the actual copies of whatever was filed. And she said she thought that the items that would have otherwise been recorded on the registry were missing. So they were missing line items, if you will. Now, what she did say...
No, I apologize for interrupting, okay. But I'm asking you a little bit different question.
All right, I misunderstood.
A piece of paper can go missing from the court file due to this computer conversion problem. Okay. Now, you believe it or not, but that's what she said. Did she offer any explanation, of why a court filing would not at least show up on the registry, even if the piece of paper went missing through the computer conversion?
Right. No, I think she did. I think I tried to answer that.
Okay.
She said that there were a number of items that didn't convert over, and they were items that should have been on, would otherwise have been on the registry, that didn't convert over once they did the computer conversion in 2002. Now, she did say also that she has no idea what they were. She can't tell. And she said they were missing entries. Interestingly, Judge Schwartz concluded in his September 14th, 2012 order granted non-pro-tunct September 6th, that she had testified that minute orders went missing. That's not what she said. She said that there were entries that were missing, and she did not know what they were. She also testified, I think importantly, that from her standpoint, if there had been a notice to show cause, since that emanates from the court, she would expect that to have been on the registry, because the court makes that entry on its own. It issues the notice to show cause and correspondingly makes the entry.
And she had no explanation for why the registry would be deficient?
She did not.
Okay. That was what I was trying to say.
Yeah, the petition to revive was on the registry, but the copy of the petition was not in the court file. All right, we have since found that, as I've mentioned, Mr. Sherman, Mr. Ware's client, had it in his file at home, and we've submitted that as part of the record. I'm almost out of time. I'm going to reserve my 20 seconds. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is David Ware. I represent Marvin Sherman, and I'm losing my voice. My bar registration number is 6026. Let's go right back to the point that Mr. Albrecht was making. The clerk of the court, Pamela Warren, testified that there were items missing from the registry of the court. I went through Exhibit 3 with her. And that's an interesting exhibit. I would urge you all, if you haven't had the opportunity to do so, take a look at it. It's a very jumbled up registry. Normally you see a chronological registry that starts, in this case, should have started about 1985, 1986 when the case was filed, and you'd expect it to go chronologically to the oldest case. It does not. It jumps and starts. It skips around. It's obviously obvious just looking at the record that it's pretty screwed up. More importantly,
is what you're referring to now is the registry, the original transactional log, or is it some kind of a computer generated document that was created as the original registry was input into machine readable form?
My understanding, and I understand the difference, my understanding from the testimony of Pamela Wren is that she prepared, it was a computer generated registry, but it was the actual court registry. And I can't tell you at what point in time, because I've been practicing long enough that those were kept in longhand when I started practicing. And so the entries would be in chronological order put in by the clerk. And I don't recall what year it was that we switched over, but I suspect it was probably before 1986 or 85. Okay. That's just from memory. Okay. So I believe, at least it was my understanding based on Pamela Loren's testimony, that what she brought to court with her was what the court uses for its registry of actions, which shows everything that has occurred in the case. The interesting thing is I started going through with Pamela Wren this Exhibit 3. We started with page 3-1, 3-2, and went through that. And there's a, and I may get the letters wrong, so I'm doing this from memory, it's VNRA, and then it goes VNRB, and then it goes VNRC. And it proceeds, and there's some jumps and skips in there, but it gets all the way to Z eventually. So it gets all the way through the alphabet. And I'm not sure we had all those entries, because when I add them up, I don't come up with 26. It's somewhere about half that number. But all of those are dated February 10, 1994, which is 2 years after the revival that we're concerned about here. They're missing. You cannot tell anything from what's there, whether that was a registry entry. There are no documents. The clerk of the court said she went back to, she was a records chief, and she said she went back and looked for the paper files to see whether the paper files had been maintained. They were gone. So apparently the clerk's office, and this was before Pamela Wren's time, so she couldn't testify about what happened, but it appeared to her that the files that were not converted into electronic files were purged, and they are gone. And this isn't the first case. Got other cases coming up to you. Tried almost the same time frame. Tried a week before this case. Same thing. Records lost. So it's not something that's unusual. I've got two cases in a row. So what we've got is approximately 26 entries / documents that are flat gone.
But you mean, but I don't want to belabor this, but you sure. Mean there's an entry in the registry, but the underlying piece of paper is MIA.
The entry has nothing to do with the date that the document was apparently entered. The date, the 2-10-1994, is the date the computer kicked them into cyberspace. Every one of those documents, when you look at Exhibit 3, there's a whole string of them, and they're all dated the same day. And that's the date apparently the computer didn't convert. That must have been the date that they did the conversion. The clerk testified there were two conversions. One was done in February 1994, and one was done in March of 1994. So how they interrelated, how they affected, bottom line is we're missing about 22nd entries and any supporting records that there might be with it. The other interesting thing is that through Mr. Albrecht's discovery, my client is hearing impaired and sight impaired, so he had some assistance during the deposition that Mr. Albrecht took by phone. He lives down in Arizona. And they came up with a page. And if I remember right, it was a signature page, but you couldn't tell what it was. And they were looking through the records during the deposition, and one of the gals, who was a former court clerk, found a page one, which appears to match, from Joseph P. Zvonkovich, who was a practicing attorney in Colorado Springs. Joseph P. Zvonkovich isn't shown as an attorney of record at any time in the case by the trial court in Colorado Springs. So that's missing. So basically, it's just, you got a file that has the order in it, the order of revival, that order of September 18th of 1992 was in the file. The petition is referred to in the registry of actions, but the document was not in the court file. And no other documents. And this isn't in this particular time period. The case started out with, I want to say, somewhere around a dozen parties. My clients were defendants, the Bows were defendants, the bank was a plaintiff. It was a lawsuit on a debt, a promissory note that was owed to one of the banks in Florida. But the bank got a judgment, and they started working on their judgment, and the Shermans got their $2.5 million judgment on cross-claim during that early part. And then there's not a tremendous amount of activity, but what's there doesn't help us. So bottom line is the record is that order. And that order gets a presumption of regularity. We went beyond that. We tried to find Joseph Zvonkovich's records. He's deceased. His widow threw the records out. We tried to take the deposition of Judge Jane Looney, the trial judge that ended the order in 1992. She has advanced Parkinson's, was not capable medically capable of providing a deposition. So we couldn't take her deposition. I'm not sure what she would have remembered that long ago anyway, but so that's the record.
Could you address counsel's timing argument? In other words, with one of the judgment debtors resident out of state, which appears to be an uncontroverted fact, how could you get that person served within 24 hours of when the court presumably issued a show cause order?
Well, to be perfectly frank with the court, it would be difficult, but would it be possible? Yes, it would. We had the fax machine alive and well in 1992. It was probably a little early for emails, but I think Bill Gates, I think, came out with his first email in the fall of 1992, if I remember right. But the fax machine was alive and well. And it's not real difficult to throw a petition and a show cause order in the fax machine and fax it out to California and have a process server go out and serve it. We had no difficulty serving Wilma Vogue in California at her home. She was personally served. When we did the motion to revive in 2012, we had her personally served at her home by Deputy Sheriff, and it was not a difficult thing to do. I don't think it would have been a difficult thing to have the two Bows serve in Pueblo. They're known people and their location is known. So, is it possible? Is there a possible explanation? Was the time period long enough to get that accomplished? I think the answer is yes. It could have been done. Whether it was done or not, again, we don't have anything other than Judge Looney saying that I have looked at the entire record. And this satisfies the requirements of Rule 54F, or G, or anyway, Rule 54, where it satisfies those requirements. It was done properly. and that order is a order of the presumption of regularity. I will address very shortly Mr. Albrecht's argument about a de novo review, and frankly, I don't think it makes any difference from a practical standpoint. And so if the court wants to do a de novo review of the court record, that's fine. The court record is the order, that's it. Everything else is missing. So what the court can find is the records aren't there and the entries aren't there, but that doesn't then go the next step to show they were never there. The court disallowed, essentially, Mr. Vogel's second testimony as not being credible. And I think the findings of the trial court are binding on this court as to credibility of witnesses. Now, the judge observed Mr. Vogel in court and heard him testify. And he did not find him to be a credible person. So that testimony isn't available. So what you have is a presumption of regularity and a court file that's missing a whole bunch of stuff. That's the record. So I don't think it makes a lot of difference whether you do a de novo review or you review it. I think you came out the same place because they're just the evidence that's there supports a revival in 1992. You have a question, it looks like, Judge Wood.
Well, my question was, wouldn't the original, you referred to a fax machine, wouldn't the original order, show cause order, have to be served?
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think copies suffice.
Okay.
Let me just, if I might, jump to one other area in the time we've got left. We've got about 4 minutes. And I want to talk about where we are. We have two revivals. We got a 1992 revival, and we have a 2012 revival, which is what I'm concerned about. First of all, 2012 is a lot different from anything else. We clearly have show cause orders issued by the clerk of the court. We clearly have Wilma Bull personally served, and we clearly have Norman Bull II served personally through substituted service. I ended up serving as attorney because we had a little difficulty making connection. But the bottom line is the court had personal jurisdiction over Wilma and over Bull II. Prior to her death. Now let's talk about her death. What's the effect of her death? She died before the hearing. First of all, remember Mr. Albrecht represented both Wilma and Beau II, but their responses were quite different. Wilma Beau never contested that she was not served with a 1992 revival. Go back and look at it. There's no affidavit. She doesn't contest it. All she says is that those things are not in the court file. Well, there are no that. But she didn't say, but I never got served. She has no affidavit. There's no evidence whatsoever from Wilma Beau in which she stated that she was not served with a 1992. We know she was served in 2012. So that was her response. It's not in the file. That had already been ruled on twice before by Judge Schwartz. There was a motion to vacate the 1992 revival order. There was a motion for reconsideration. Both of those were denied. I asked Judge Schwartz in our response, our final response, asking him to deny the motion to vacate, asked him to rule on our motion for revival as to Wilma because there were no facts or law at issue. He was ready to be ruled. That didn't happen. We should have because it would have solved the next problem. What happens when Wilma dies? Well, it doesn't. The court doesn't lose jurisdiction when a party dies. The case goes into abeyance. And there's a reasonable period of time to substitute the estate. So what did Mr. Sherman do? Mr. Sherman, on the 18th of August, opened probate in Fremont County, Colorado, Canyon City. Why do you do that? Because there was a piece of real property that was located there that we believe belonged in Wilma's estate. What happened? We're mid-August, we're asking to open a probate as a creditor, filed a petition for probate. So what does the probate court do? Well, Judge Julie Marshall, who happens to be a dear friend of mine, but sometimes doesn't make some good decisions. This is one. She ruled that she would not admit the petition to probate. She would hold the case indefinitely until this court, I'm talking about us right here, this court makes a ruling on the appeal. Now, let me go back because you're wondering, what appeal? This is back in August of 2012. Mr. Albrecht filed a notice of appeal when Judge Schwartz denied his first motion to vacate. And we had pending at that time our motion to revive the judgment. I'm a little over, is that all right?
Well, I think you're out of time if you could wrap up in a sentence.
Okay, let me just wrap up. But the bottom line is we did not, we tried to get a PR appointed so we could substitute into the case. We were basically frustrated by the actions of the probate court in Canyon City.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your attention and for all your good questions.
Mr. Ware indicated that the record includes just the September 14, 1992 order. I don't believe that to be true. It does include the registry of actions, and yes, there are mysteries associated with some of the entries. There is no evidence other than the general reference in Judge Looney's order to the applicable rules being followed. And in fact, when you look at the timing, as I mentioned, and you look at the fact that Mr. Zbankovich sent a letter on September 16 saying that the order had been granted or had been entered administratively, that says something to me, that the rules simply were not followed. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.